All right. And neither were we. And we were so glad that Tom Petty's family stepped up in regards to Tom Petty's wishes that his song not be used by tyrants and bigots. And and they stood up for social justice, and I'm very, very happy about that. It's a wonderful song, and I'd hate to have it continue to be used at Trump rallies. This is Chris. It's a Peace and Justice program, and I'm very happy to be with you here today. I have on the line with me a special person, and I wanted to introduce him to you before I let him say a word. And he is a co-author of an important new book called Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions. His name is Michael Barron, and he got his doctorate in cultural anthropology with a certificate in cognitive psychology, researching how culture and cognition interact in the way that people learn about categories of difference and bias, and how to most effectively communicate to change patterns of thinking. He spent some time in academia, teaching at Harvard and University of Michigan. He also spent several years doing applied cultural research for the Frameworks Institute and the American Institutes for Research. While working at these institutions, he also started consulting for organizations around diversity and inclusion issues, and now does that work full-time as a senior partner and digital solutions lead in InQuest Consulting. He co-authored this book with Dr. Tiffany Jana. She is the CEO of TMI Portfolio, a collection of companies working to advance inclusive workplaces. TMI Consulting, a TMI Portfolio company, is a 2018 Best for the World B Corporation. She also co-authored Overcoming Bias and the second edition of the B Corp Handbook. I want to welcome you to the show. Hi, Michael Barron.
Thank you, Chris. Fantastic to be here.
Yeah, it is. This is such a wonderful book. I just have to tell you that I want to be an ally. I want to always do the right things. And I know that having read this book, Subtle Acts of Exclusion, that sometimes intention isn't enough, that one can cause harm very easily. And I'd like you to talk a little bit about, I guess we can start with, I got to get organized here a little bit, but can you start with talking about the difference between microaggression, which some of us have heard about, mm-hmm. and the new framing of this called Subtle Acts of Exclusion?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you think of the whole range of, you know, violence that can be done, harm that can be done, exclusion that can be done, there's a wide range, right? Some of it is very explicit and visible, and some of it is more under the surface and invisible, some, you know, unconscious biases, for example. And some of these things, like you mentioned, where people aren't necessarily intending to do harm, but that is the impact that they're having on a day-to-day basis through these interactions. So people, these kinds of things have been happening again and again and again forever, right? And they happen every day to people of marginalized identities. So things like, you know, oh, I don't even see you as black, or wow, you're so articulate, or so professional, or so well-spoken. And these are things that have been called microaggressions. And the research shows us that we're not seeing a lot of improvement around these. And that's a serious problem, because it's creating people to be not satisfied in their jobs, to be frustrated. It causes mental health, anxiety, and even physical health when people experience these all the time. So people call these microaggressions, and there's a lot of awareness built around these. But what Tiffany and I would find kind of independently, you know, as you mentioned, we work for different organizations, but what we aligned on is that maybe one of the problems is just the way that term frames the whole issue, you know, what it is and what's at stake. Because what happens is you're in a workshop or in a talk and you're trying to tell people, hey, that might have been a microaggression when you said, you know, you're so well-spoken. And on one hand, it created this defensiveness, like, I wasn't intending to be aggressive at all. How can you call that a microaggression? You don't know what I was thinking, right? extreme defensiveness, and then signaling to everyone else that these are only a small problem, micro, not very big. And neither of those things was very helpful, right? And so what we thought is, let's try to reconceptualize this whole thing by just calling these what they are. They're subtle. That's what makes them confusing and insidious and difficult to talk about. They're acts, right? They're things people say and do, not necessarily intentions. And what's the net effect is that they exclude people. So with this reframing, we then can build a deeper understanding of what these are and how to actually go about building trust and closeness and inclusion rather than setting up an adversarial relationship.
Yeah. And this framework is important because you're telling people they're invisible, they're inadequate, they don't belong, they're not an individual, they're not normal, they're a curiosity, a threat, a burden. I mean, this is very important work. I mean, if we are laying this stuff on each other, I was so appreciative to read it because I had to really, really rethink things that had happened in my life part of this. In other words, what you would call the initiator. So
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about maybe attributional ambiguity, the reason why we don't stop and think when we've done something, or, you know, we walk away and then we think about it 5 minutes later and we never think about it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, part of what happens is people just aren't necessarily familiar with the lived experiences of people who might be different than them. And so, you know, you're trying to just ask a question or tell a joke or to bond. That's your intention, right? But underneath the surface might be communicated all those things you mentioned. You're not normal. You're inadequate. And so, but it's under the surface, right? And so a lot of times, because of the subtlety, if you experience a subtle act of exclusion like this, you might be thinking like, wait, did that even just happen? Or like, what did that person mean by that? And by the time you kind of figure out what you might want to say, the moment's passed, and we all, you know, those are hard conversations anyways, so maybe we don't speak up. And the person that said it, the initiator, I mean, we're all initiators of these things at some point. That's one of the main messages in the book. These are happening, and we all do them, and it shouldn't be like record scratch, like stop the presses, a subtle act of exclusion just happened, but we should expect them to happen because they are happening. And sometimes if you're the initiator, you don't even recognize it, or if you're not directly affected, you don't even recognize it. Like subtle acts of exclusion that might happen to women, for example, all the time. Men who observe it, they might not even recognize it as a subtle act of exclusion. It might just fly under the radar. Or something that happens, you know, to someone with a disability, for example. You might not even recognize it because you're just not familiar enough to recognize that even as a subtle act of exclusion. So there's a lot going on, and it is very subtle, and we are human, and so that makes it even more complicated, and we like to have social interactions that go well, and we don't like to cause discomfort in other people, so that contributes to the difficulty in speaking up about it. There's a lot going on.
So I'm speaking with Michael Barron. He is the co-author of Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions. And I'd like the listeners to just ask themselves, so that you can kind of own this a little more, have you ever experienced subtle things at work that make you feel disrespected, undervalued, or as if you don't belong? Have you felt excluded, even bullied? And I know that we are not really focused on just whoever, but really the people that are so deeply hurt by these are people with marginalized identities. And Michael Barron, can you define that for us? I'd like to understand a little bit more about some of the important chapters in this book where you do talk from the point of view and give many examples of people with marginalized identities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So when you think about, you know, groups and how people identify, there are groups that are more privileged over others, right? And that's partly because of the way that structures work to maintain that privilege, and part of the way that our minds and culture work to keep that privilege going. And to, you know, so some groups of people, whether we're talking about race or gender or sexuality or religion or disability, whatever it is we're talking about, some groups of people are considered, like, are valued more, are more quote-unquote normal, are, you know, have more access to resources, and the other groups who are not, we call those marginalized, right? There's nothing inherently wrong or unequal or not normal about those people, but they are being marginalized by other people, by systems, and by the culture. And so that's what we mean by that. And so, you know, our goal, of course, if we're really looking to, you know, create change in our society, our goal is to get to a point where that doesn't happen along these group dynamics, where people aren't differentially valued, but everyone is valued.
Yes, and one of the things that you talk about that I underline for myself, because these so quickly can personalize, like the sentences I read, about listening, you know, avoid comparing pain, leverage our own pain in service of connection and understanding. I think some of this is so deep and so important for each of us, you know, in our own way, based on our own life experiences. You are so careful here about avoiding blame, shame, maligning or embarrassing people. I was wondering if you could read the Think Before You Speak bullets on page 38.
Yeah, of course. Let me just grab that here. Okay, think before you speak. Okay, so is what I'm about to say or ask based on stereotypes or assumptions about a marginalized group? Is what I'm about to say or ask unnecessarily intrusive? Am I overstepping? Is what I'm about to say based in kindness and generosity or the opposite? Do I have the authority or the right to tell or ask this person to comply with my request? Is this a good use of my authority or privilege? Would I say the same thing to a person of a different gender or color or race? Is this going to make that person feel inadequate or as if they don't belong? Does this question their normalcy or make them feel like a threat or a curiosity? And will this make someone feel invisible, as if they're not an individual? So these are, you know, obviously when you go to speak with anyone, right, you're not kind of pausing for 5 minutes to go through a checklist. But the idea is, if you can build up these mental muscles and these behaviors and this way of thinking, this is the kind of thinking that will happen a little more automatically before you're speaking with people. And so you just get in better habits.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I wish it wasn't COVID. I wanted to rush out and start talking to people to practice my new thinking and skills from the book.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, you can still do it over the phone and over Zoom. These subtle acts of exclusion are still happening, even with COVID times.
Yes, I can blow it anywhere. So I'd like to go over the guidelines. I think that people will want to read the book, even if we give away a whole bunch of what's in the book, because it's important and it's something that, you know, that you need to really grasp more deeply than what we're able to do in 25 minutes. But can you talk about the steps in terms of how you would, if somebody had initiated a subtle act of exclusion and it was within your hearing and you were an ally to this person, how would you handle it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So if it's not directly, you know, if it doesn't, not directed at you necessarily, but you recognize it as a subtle act of exclusion, this is really an important time for allies to be able to speak up. We need to shift the burden from these marginalized people to, for speaking up all the time, to other people being able to speak up. You know, a white person being able to tell another white person, hey, you know, I don't know about that. Can we talk about it, right? So if you're that person, what are some good guidelines? And, you know, it's not always the perfect moment to talk about this stuff, especially if you're at work, but it often can be, and it's often important to do it, and there can be tremendous benefits from doing it. And what we've, you know, as you mentioned, I work in diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting. So along with my colleagues and with Tiffany, we figured out when these conversations go well, what is it about them that made it go well? And so for these people who want to be allies, and again, I'll stress the importance of, you can't just be an ally in your head, right? You have to actually do things and say things. That's what makes you an ally. So one thing you can do is pause the action, right? Sometimes we try to, like I mentioned before, you try to figure out the perfect thing to say in your head, and by then the moment's passed and you didn't say anything. It's okay to just say, hey, something's feeling not right about this. I'm wondering if we can talk about it later, right? I don't even know yet why it's making me feel a certain way, but can we talk about this? That's one great thing to do. If you can put people at ease about their intent, try as much as possible to get them to not fall into a defensive position. Like, hey, I know you didn't mean anything bad by this, but when you said it, it made me feel like I was being, you know, considered not normal. Right? So trying to focus on impact rather than intent. Trying to then, you know, explain, okay, well, you know, I spoke up about this. Can we talk about it together? Can I tell you a little bit more about this? And, you know, having patience is important because for some people, like, this might be the first time they heard about it. But also expecting progress, right? If you give someone feedback that what they said might have been a subtle act of exclusion and they just keep doing it, well, then you can't really assume good intent anymore if they're not taking in that feedback. Then it's a different situation. And so those are great guidelines if you want to be an ally. If you're the person that spoke up, there are important things you've got to do too. There's a big burden on you. If someone says, hey, I'm not sure about that, you know, you've got to kind of be ready to not be defensive, but to ask questions, to understand the impact on the other person. You've got to really follow through. If someone gives you that gift of feedback, I mean, we all want to be, well, not all of us, most of us want to be better people and are trying hard to do that. If someone gives us feedback about a way we could be even better or be more inclusive, what a gift they're giving us. And we really have to take it as that gift that it is.
Yeah. And by practicing with these steps, it seems like from the many, many examples in the book that you can have success in communicating and helping people not have to experience these subtle acts of exclusion. One of the things that you write about from your background is part of this is the chapter on race and ethnicity, and I think that our listeners would benefit, as I did, from understanding race and ethnicity a little bit better, because I think we all get a little confused, and it helps to have some of the basic pieces of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. You know, so for people, right, race often means one thing, like maybe they're an identity that they feel strongly, or like a culture, right? So that people feel that. As a social scientist, I kind of think of it, race as a story that we tell ourselves about biological difference. And those ideas about different, notice I'm not saying it's actual biological difference, because genetically we are not divided up into distinct racial groups. That is not true. But we tend to think that that is true, especially implicitly. But it's not. But those ideas about difference play into a system of unequal power distribution, and that's the problem. I don't draw a very strict line between race and ethnicity. They're, you know, as humans, we group people into groups, and we sometimes assume that those groups are naturally different, and sometimes that falls into what we might consider the domain of race. Sometimes it falls into the domain of what we might think of as ethnicity, but I think of them very similar in terms of just how are our brains thinking about those differences that we assume to be natural. I remember I went around and for a digital program that I created, an e-learning program, I went around and interviewed 150 people and asked them, how do you identify your race? And, you know, you might think maybe you'd get 10 or 12 different answers based on that question. How do you identify your race? We actually found over 70 different answers to that question, because people answered it in terms of things that I would have thought of as nationality or ethnicity or language or something else. But there's no clear-cut domain or difference between race and ethnicity in that respect.
We're running out of time, Michael Barron, and I want people to look into this book. It is for sale now, just published with Barrett Kohler Publishing in 2020. It's called Subtle Acts of Exclusion, How to Understand, Identify, and Stop Microaggressions. If in 1 minute or two we could end on the examples of intentional acts of inclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so important, right? Where do we go from here? How do we get somewhere better, you know, collectively? And so I think what you're talking about is in our conclusion chapter, where we kind of imagine a world, right,
yeah,
where people aren't assuming the worst about others based on how they look or act or sound, but a world full of thoughtful people who consider the impact of their words and actions before releasing them into the universe, you know, where equity becomes a reality, you know, where we make others feel you are enough, you are an individual, you do belong. You are normal. You are special. You are safe.
Thank you so much, Michael Barron, and your co-author, Tiffany Jana, for this book, Subtle Acts of Exclusion. Thank you for being my guest on the Peace and Justice program today.
Thank you, Chris.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I already have somebody to pass this book on to, but I do highly suggest in these times that we all be reading and catching up on our humanity and the wonderful offerings that are coming out in so many different venues, and this being one of them, Subtle Acts of Exclusion. All right, I'm going to put on some Sweet Honey on the Rock, and I'm going to get our next guest on the line. But first, I'd like to thank our underwriters. We really need to be supporting our underwriters during COVID, as a lot of businesses are threatened. Peace and Justice is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, salad bar, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. Chico Natural Foods Co-op is open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico. Also, Sonia Airy, an Allstate insurance agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and goals. For more information about protecting your life, home, vehicle or boat, or to roll over your 401 account, call Sonia at 345-2351. Also like to thank the local, seasonal, and organic offerings at Farmstar Pizza, where the farmer is the star. Farmstar features artisan pizzas, salads, appetizers, and desserts with vegan and gluten-free offerings, craft beer, and eclectic wines. Farmstar Pizza is open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner, with live music on Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday at 2359 The Esplanade. Visit farmstarpizza.com, and you can like them on Facebook. We also want to acknowledge the 2020 census. You can safely participate from your home, online, or over the phone. Please count everyone in your home, even if they're staying with you temporarily. The form is made of 9 questions, all confidential, and participation helps ensure our community gets the federal funding and representation it needs for the next decade. For information, you can visit californiacensus.org online or call them 844-330-2020. And it is just about the top of the hour. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And just in case I need to say it, the opinions voiced on the program do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, or underwriters, just mine. So go ahead for some sweet honey right now.
Spring chicken, I'm not 20.
I like that. Get that wrong. Here we go.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian? Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person and a Garrett, a Truth, a fugitive, or a slave? Would you harbor a Haitian, Korean, or Czech, a lesbian, or a gay? Would you
Sweet Honey on the Rock. And I have on the line with me Maurice Martin. He is a U.S. Army veteran and lifetime member of Veterans for Peace. He's been on the board. He's been a board member of a chapter in Berkeley. He has served in leadership positions as part of the Veterans for Peace Speakers Bureau, Outreach Coordinator, Vice President, and even President. He's a founder of the Veterans for Peace First National Student Veteran Club and helped facilitate the first Veterans for Peace Tijuana, Mexico chapter, and was a housing program and the housing program for deported veterans. He's also served on a number of community and national veterans organizations. He's also been a student at UC Berkeley, majoring in peace and conflict studies with associates of art degrees and honors in global studies and labor studies from Berkeley City College and San Diego City College, respectively. He is a certified mediator in restorative justice mediator, alternatives to violence, and a conference meeting facilitator. He's dedicated himself in advancing veteran and mental health issues as a 20-year independent organizer, building empowerment with the community and disenfranchised around the country on issues and campaigns around homelessness, fair housing, tenant rights, worker and labor union issues, as well as disability rights. He was named one of the 50 most notable disability advocates by the California Department of Rehabilitation on their 50th anniversary. And he's done a bunch of other stuff too, but I'm going to stop there so we can actually talk and just stop talking
Jesus
about you.
Lord, I'm tired.
I know. Wear us all out. Maurice, welcome.
If I ever do anything again, you're going to be my publicist.
Oh, good, good. I like that. Maurice and I found ourselves on a very long trip to Standing Rock, and Maurice never got to Standing Rock because he set up a clinic at Eagle Point because so many veterans were flooding in from all over the country, and many of them had health issues. And so he did a little MASH unit there for about 3 days, as I recall. Is that how you remember it?
Yes, and it was longer than 3 days from the moment we set foot to the moment we left in the blizzard, or at least the day after the big blizzard there where everybody abandoned ship. Yeah, we did a lot of good work there, but we had a lot of help from a lot of veterans. It was one of the most fulfilling aspects of my life there, and one of the few times that, and I think I'm not alone in this, that I really felt proud in wearing the uniform again.
Hmm. Yeah, it really was amazing time to be there. And at that point, we felt that we had accomplished something by that huge number of people showing up, and Obama backed down and got the Corps of Engineers to close out that permit for the pipeline. You know, I want to ask you, that brings up from...
What was so surprising about this, and I'm sorry, I won't take up long.
No,
there
please.
Was a call from the veteran community and from the Native American community for about 300 veterans to show up.
Yeah.
And what came about was 5,000 veterans from around the country. It was freaking amazing. And you know, the interesting thing about this, people were canceling elective surgeries. People came off their sick beds. People came off of everywhere just to be a part of that moment, to stand with our Native Americans, who not only are Native American, but indigenous people from around the world.
Yeah.
You know, it was about 12 to 13 to, I mean, some say 20,000 people down in Standing Rock. I only had an opportunity to visit there a couple of times, but we were very busy. But we wouldn't have been able to do that with our coalition of veteran medics, Marines, the Marine Corpsmen, so I can remember their name, the Marine Corpsmen, and some sailors and all sorts of people, where we were able to liberate some supplies in order to start what turned out to be one of the first infirmaries in the Native American community there. So it was very exciting, and it stayed there for about a year or so until they were able to start their own building, brick-and-mortar hospital or clinic there. So we were very excited about that movement there. It was really exciting.
Yeah, I didn't realize that infirmary lasted that long that you started. Well, and thank you for that.
Yeah, because it was the only one that was there. Yeah. We had set that place up with some support and help from experts there. We had set that place. You could do almost anything there except maybe dental surgery and some type of medical surgery, but just about everything else you could do. And we had about 13 beds there.
Hmm. That's so, something we could probably
we
just
that
talk
out from
about
a
that.
Closet, which was a bunch of storage room, and spent a couple of days just cleaning that out, and then getting supplies and stuff. As you know, there were a bunch of medics and corpsmen and stuff who were supplying the Standing Rock proper. But we pulled a lot of team together, and we were able to, I think, do something significant that was a benefit not only to the Native American community who were living there, but also the veterans and other people around the world who were coming to the clinic, because they were overrun down there in Sandy Rock. So we had the space available. We had a large cafeteria room that was able to get a lot of people there, and also be able to get a lot of people who came ill, who just wanted to be there, but also needed emergency to get back home. So they, with the help of donations from veterans, we were able to get a lot of people back home and back with their families safe and sound.
That's it. It was remarkable. And now we have about five topics and less than 20 minutes to talk about them. So I wanted to...
Okay, let me just finish one thing.
Yeah.
And I'll be in. As happy and as proud as I was, the only bad memory of this is that we lost our driver over the last couple of months. And I was very sad to hear that. Richard he was an amazing character and very supportive, and that's the only sort of bad part of this whole thing is remembering him and the loss of him and his help and support alone in all veteran issues.
Rest in peace, Barry Binks. Yeah.
Yes, Barry. Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Maurice. Yeah. And you have continued to work on health issues, both mental health and the whole VA issue. And I don't know if people are aware that the Trump administration and the Republican Party are trying to privatize the VA. Can you tell the listeners about that?
Yes, and it, this is such a large issue, so I'll try to be summarized. So.
Okay.
So this is the second round of this thing. They started in the late 80s in trying to destroy the brick-and-mortar hospitals and privatize them, and actually was spearheaded by John McCain, surprisingly. So we were able to defend that off. Recently, over the last 10 years, 8 years, it has been on the Republican agenda, but only since Donald Trump did they really begin to start really enacting and trying to privatization of the VA hospital. And you've been seeing a lot of propaganda against the VA on whatever the issues are, being able to have access, the long waiting times, miscues on diagnoses and so forth and so on. There's a lot to unpack there, but sort of let me give you an overview here. There's nothing wrong with the VA that fully staffing and fully funding would not solve.
All right.
If we expand the nerve, we would need these rural areas and people driving hundreds of miles and doing the other program that they want to do. If we provided more clinics out into abandoned urban areas, or in particular out in our rural areas, where you're in Colorado, Wyoming, just name your spot, or Kansas. If we expand some of those, or New Mexico, if we expand those community services out and about and fully fund the VA, then a lot of these self-inflicted wounds could be solved. And if we stop fighting, the most supportive group is our nurses, which are part of the National Nurses Association. We stop trying to privatize and defund those guys and get them to end their union, we will be a lot better to concentrate on veterans. And I will say to the end of this, even though it's about privatization, but I want to say what this is about. The VA hospital and the veterans are in the most intimate relationship that you can have. Here you have families who are offering up their children, their sons, their daughters, brothers, sisters, cousins, just name your family member, into a situation where they're putting their lives at risk. many of them losing life. But those who are those who are lucky enough to survive are put back in the system in which our taxpayers, those family members, are supporting the things where people both sweat and put both sweat and blood into the ground. And that is the most intimate relationship. And then what you have now is trying to have greedy, profit-bearing corporations trying to insert themselves between that relationship for profit and not in turn for veterans. They care little about veterans. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we've done studies now to know that the outcomes in going into the private care has not been good for veterans. But it also has the extended consequence of veterans losing their voice. How can I know that many veterans have Agent Orange, depleted uranium, other kind of poisons in their bodies? How can they speak with one voice on disability issues or mental health issues? How can I know that there's been more or less women who have dealing with military sexual trauma, traumatic brain injury? We take away our voice. When we separate our veterans from our community, you separate us from the ability to speak with one voice. And it's a scientific way. You're not able to catch symptoms quick enough to be able to do something until they become a crisis. So there's lots of reasons that we need to maintain our ability to our intimate relationship with the taxpayers in our community and not have corporations for profit inserting themselves between that relationship.
Yeah, that's one part of the military budget I completely support. Maurice Martin, you also work with homeless vets and deported vets. Can you talk about those groups?
I can.
Forever.
Homelessness in particular and our deported vets. I've been intimately involved with both of them. Did they do those disclaimers and stuff? Well, first of all, I have to mention that I spent 8 years homeless. And also struggled with substance abuse and alcoholism. I'm a two-time suicide survivor and self-mutilator. So there's a lot to unpack there. All the things that contribute are either a part of homelessness or contributed to you to be homeless. Now, the homeless population in general, I guess I should start about talk about who we're talking about. The homeless is a big issue, and so that's what it is. So I'm trying to encapsulate this 20 years of stuff into a little thing. I've been involved in both homeless issues, both as an advocate, a staff person, and working on all sorts of Blue Ribbon Task Force, both local, state, and federal government of Blue Ribbon Task Force. Mm-hmm. And it is very scary out here now, and I've been working on it for 20 years, and I've watched us go from single men to women, then women with children, and now families. And this is not your veteran, your middle-aged veteran out on Skid Row drinking a bottle of Ripple anymore. So this is a much larger issue and crisis. The issue is that homeless people range in the millions or so. And depending on who you talk to, the National Coalition for Veteran Homelessness, the National Association to End Homelessness, just name your organization, all sort of have flux on who how many people are. But the genesis is that out of all the general homeless population, veterans make up about 30% nationally, and no matter what your local area is, they make up about 30% of the homeless population there. And one of the most scariest things that I've seen over the last 20 years is that we used to have veterans, people who were experiencing homelessness for a short period of time. Now, what I'm witnessing and that I've seen over my 20 years is that we are seeing third-generation homeless people. That means where the original family member was homeless, now the daughter's homeless, the grandma's homeless, and now their children. And neither one of those generations have spent less than 3 months in their own bed, and many of them have never experienced their own bed. So yeah, we have a serious problem out here.
That is serious.
Veterans as a unique situation in that we have served And our issue is maybe not are different, but they're different, but they're not unique. The main reason that we have homelessness, of course, across the board is not individual deficiency, substance abuse, alcohol, mental health issues. The main issue is economic.
Right.
It's the difference between what people earn and what they have to pay for rent. That is our biggest issue. The second one, along with eviction rate, is evictions. But that is tied directly to economic interruption, medical care, high cost of bills, loss of job, a family member who got sick, where you can't afford to the two families are paying for an apartment. One of them gets sick or one has to stay home with the child. They can't afford the apartment. They fall behind. And 90 days, then anywhere from 30 to 90 days after that, they are evicted. So eviction is a big problem. The difference with non-lease compliant issues, where you have a landlord who is, you know, a substandard landlord who are not doing repair issues, and people begin to start reducing their rent in order to encourage the landlord to fix whatever issues that are going there, and the landlord's retaliation evicts people. So there's a lot of reasons out there. For veterans, our issue is economic first. Second, medical issues. We have veterans who are just not single. For our veterans, it's gone from single men to older single people to single veteran women to single veteran women with children. And now we have whole families. And we don't have a system in place or a program in place to address those issues, and it leaves a lot of people in jeopardy. We are not using the tools and programs that we need. We've made some significant steps under the Obama administration and housed a lot of veterans. But we've only housed the veterans that were housed and not the coming veterans that are coming in. So we're in a very difficult spot, and the coronavirus has only exacerbated it, where we have outreach programs that are not attended to. We don't know how many veterans we have out there, which is another problem.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot get the right temperature of people. You got a sick patient. You come in, you take their temperature, and you cannot wait the next year to come back and take their temperature set, you know, to find out if they got better or got worse. So this public being able to do a point-in-time count, where you go out and count both either homeless or the veterans have one. You cannot do that once a year and be able to get a good temperature gauge on who's homeless, how they're homeless, what are their situations, what are their needs. You can't do that once or twice a year, and nor can you do that with volunteers. This needs to be a dedicated staff that do this multiple times a year, so you can catch those who, before they become homeless and homeless prevention, those who are recently homeless, and those who are long-term homeless or homeless based upon issues that they're dealing with, substance abuse, alcohol, mental health. If we solve some of those issues, we can reduce access to the ER at 80%. We can reduce truancy almost to nothing, and we can reduce the ability for returning to jails and prisons almost at 70%. It was just a case of housing. And if you have mental health issues, substance abuse, alcohol, if you do that without housing, don't attach housing is our linchpin for the successful completion of that treatment. If you do that without housing, you have less than 50% chance of staying clean, sober, and mentally stable for less than a year. If you add housing to that treatment, then you have longer than 5 years, and you tend to thrive rather than just exist. So the advent of the overall game of providing more accessible, affordable, safe housing is the name of the game, and veterans can be a big voice and to address homeless issues all around, because we have something that the others don't, and we have some credibility there because we have served our country, and so we can be used as uplifters for all veterans in the streets.
Yeah, I completely agree about housing first, how important it is, and also about the moral authority of vets. I have great respect for that. And
housing first is a key, but
yeah.
Here's the problem with it. We got to stop cherry picking who we're going to help, or just helping the most scared people, or the schizophrenic, those who are most scared of, the schizophrenic, and leave our most vulnerable population, single women, women who have been coming in, going to the military service because they were sexually abused at home, didn't get to the service to get sexually abused, then come out and they're at 60% chance again while homeless to be in sex abuse again. So we're in some serious problems that housing would help resolve this issue. And housing first is a great thing because we're not talking about treating people first and then we're putting them in houses and then bringing treatment behind. But we decided to stop cherry picking, then the cherry picking the flavor of the month. Women this month, sister friend is that month, you know, long-term homelessness this month. We have to address it from a holistic way and not just start trying to pinpoint, and because we have little resources, we need fully fund those issues to get all this particular veterans, but all veterans off the street. Homelessness is not just a housing issue. It is a health care issue. And if you didn't know that before, along with coronavirus, you know it now.
Yeah. Okay, so we have like 4 minutes,
sorry.
Maurice Martin.
And big issues,
we have huge issues to talk about. Unfortunately, I want to skip deported veterans and just hear about what you've been doing on the border, because I was really dismayed yesterday about the High Court, the Supreme Court, going against asylum seekers in the way that they did. And can you just tell us about your work on the border?
Well, my work on the border, and it ties to our deported veterans because they are the leads in this. We're only supporters.
Okay.
Of course, I go down there frequently, and we have our they are part of the Veterans for Peace Deported Veterans Advocacy Project. And those just at the border are called the Unified United States Deported Veterans, who are led by deported veterans, both Robert and Hector. And we have some other veterans in lead, who are leaders down there as well. But you got to remember that we have a significant, let's start from the beginning. We have so many deported veterans, but we have a significant amount of veterans who are in detention. We don't know how many because they won't ask the question, are you a veteran? If they actually ask that question, that would trigger a certain amount of legal rights that they have, whether it be Veterans Court and or ACLU and some others. So that would trigger. So we need to ask them, and they're not getting their rights to say, hey, I was a veteran and I served in the country. That has to do with your ability to be able to be deported, and that is not happening. Now, if we go back to homeless, deporting veterans is really putting veterans in permanent homelessness, literally, and separating families and all that sort of thing. But we believe that there are over, and this is just a sort of statistical of what we think, who's going from home and veterans. We think there's about a little over 3,000 who have been deported. And so, but a significant number of them, 100 or so, are in Tijuana, Mexico. They're all over Central and South America, and places where we actually went and recruited people. So then to use them and then toss them away like Kleenex tissue is reprehensible to me. But here's the good news. The deported veterans down there who have been separated from their families, abandoned by their country, is representing our country once again and working with the immigrant, migrants, asylum seekers. For over 3 years now, they're providing clothing, food, water, shelter, places where they a job training program. They've been building community with other faith-based organizations, social organizations, even develop relationships with the Tijuana local government and federal government. They have done great work, and they have built great partnerships with a lot of people who can go without support, myself, Jan Rubin, George Johnson, Willie Hayes. I mean, so there's many people with Veterans for Peace. And so giving them as much support as we can. They have provided safe places and spaces for them to stop the kidnappings, to provide more education benefits, partner with faith-based organizations to give them education. And the most recent project is to provide these new water filtration things. I'm not an engineer, but the idea is that in places like Little Haiti and Tijuana and some of the other enclaves, that they had no water, so they were dependent upon people on the outside to bring them, you know, bottled water, and then we bought a couple of tanks, and we transferred. The tanks are all empty. So Veterans for Peace, along with the Deported Veterans Advocacy Project and the Unified United States Veterans, has started a project where there is a new system that makes its own clean, accessible water, a renewable water sort of stuff. So the technology is a little bit beyond me, but we've been out raising funds, and we've been able to place that in three locations where now where water was not existent or accessible to them except by people donation and or traveling long distances, you know, to get it. and bring it back to their families. Now they have clean access at their disposal, you know, just like any other normal human being should have. So I'm very proud of the work that they've been doing down there. At the same time, we're working with families and with the gay, lesbian, and transgender immigrant, migrant, asylum seekers, creating a safe place and space for them. We've been able to work with other states who work with veteran interests to get them to provide housing and safe places for them because they are most at risk. And those with disabilities, we work with other organizations, those because, you know, everyone doesn't come there healthy. It may even start out healthy, but by the time they make it here, they're not as healthy as they were before. So we're working with them on trying to get good medical care. We got doctors coming in, you know, and trying to help them. And also single women who are across the border with children. Mm-hmm. And trying to stop this egregious separation of families. It's horrible.
It is.
So the deported veterans down there have been doing a great job on behalf of our government. It is taking us from being egregious to actually putting a good face on being an American in a foreign land.
Yeah, they continue to serve. Maurice Martin, we're going to have to wrap it up. I'd like to get you back next week. I'm going to contact you after the show because we were also going to talk about mental health with COVID and the death of George Floyd and some of the other important issues. I mean, we have transformational change happening in the country right now, and I'd like you to be able to address it. So, is that okay, Rain Check?
I would love so. This has been a great conversation. I am so glad to hear your voice again. This is great to hear you. We have to do more of this.
All right. Thank you so much for being my guest on the Peace and Justice program. And please stay safe. Please.
And the same to you. And also to your listeners out there, make sure that you hunker down, wear your mask, and stay safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. So the Peace and Justice program is an important part of the fabric of our community, and I'm so glad for listeners for being with us today that you could hear that amazing man. He was talking really fast because he has so much information to share with us. I should have scheduled that for an hour, so my apologies. I'm going to give you some music here from Emma's Revolution, and the song has to do with those of us who are getting the gray hairs or have had them for a long time. I'm going to celebrate another time around the sun tomorrow, so this one goes out to me.
Tell me I should wash it away.
Revolution. And this is Chris, and you are listening to the Peace and Justice program. We're here every Friday from 11:30 to 1 o'clock with rotating hosts. And I have on the line with me another veteran with a completely different experience and different life trajectory. His name is Bob Van Fleet. He's only been in Chico a couple of years. He grew up in rural Ohio for the first 18 years of his life in a very small town. His dad was a pharmacist and owned a drugstore. His mom was active in the Presbyterian Church. He would do all kinds of stuff with his grandfather, like camping and squirrel hunting, and learned about the natural world that way. It was an all-white town, and but everything changed for him in 1963 when he moved after his dad died, and he moved to Fullerton, California, graduated from high school there, and then went on to college at Humboldt State, where in 1965, where he got a degree in psychology. Then the Vietnam War came along. He was drafted in 1969, enlisted in the Navy, became a hospital corpsman in the Navy, and was lucky enough not to go to Vietnam. He got out after a year with an honorable discharge, and at 22 was adrift and not knowing too much, but started to attend anti-war teach-ins, reading the alternative news, and kind of quickly picked up an anti-military political stance and attended a lot of demonstrations and stuff. And I want to talk more about that, but I just want to end this in saying that he worked the next 40 years in Humboldt County providing services to people with disabilities. He was appointed to the California Governor's Committee for Employment of People with Disabilities in 2003, and he moved to Chico in 2018 and has been a very active member with the Chico Peace Vigil Chat, Chico Housing Action Team, the Social Justice Committee of the Unitarian Fellowship, and the Democratic Socialists here, as well as North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition. Welcome to KZFR, Bob Van Fleet.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, I was so delighted when you took on coordinating the Chico Peace Endeavor Vigil, and I don't know what led you to want to take on that responsibility. Linda Furr had been doing it for probably 16 or 17 years, and before her, Barb Castro, and before that, of course, the founder, Willa Taggart and Helen Kinney. What made you want to come out every Saturday and stand on a hot or cold or rainy corner for an hour?
Well, I've only been involved with the Peace Vigil for a little over a year and a half. And before I moved to Chico, I came to Chico for almost 40 years to attend sprint car races at the fairgrounds. Hmm. So I kind of knew the town, and on those weekends that I was here on a Saturday, I'd go by that corner, and I would see the people out there, and I would, of course, go by and honk my horn and wave and give the peace sign and raise the fist and all that. Had no idea I would ever be among those people out there, but when my marriage ended in 2018 and I chose to move to Chico because I kind of knew my way around here a little bit, that was one of the first things I did. I went down to the corner on a Saturday and became part of it. I met Linda, and that's become a real highlight. I really look forward to that, to hang out with some really, really fine people for an hour or so on a Saturday. And I know I got to meet, I learned some of the history of the vigil, and I know that it's been going on for 60 years or so, and it may be the longest running continuous peace vigil in the United States. So I've been really proud to be a newcomer, but to be a part of that. So when Linda and some of the other older timers there began talking about, you know, maybe having to draw back a little bit and limit their participation, and Linda totally surprised me when she asked me if I would kind of be, I don't know what the job title is exactly, but if I would help get the signs down there and sort of orient newcomers down there and explain some of the you know, the rules about not blocking the sidewalk and all of that kind of stuff. And I was really, really surprised and again, proud to be asked to do that. And Linda is still very much involved. She still comes down and hopefully will do that for a long, long time to come. But we're kind of co-coordinators at this point.
Mm-hmm. You know, as I listen to you speak, I'm really struck by the fact that you have really changed so much in the length of your life. You're about my age, and you started off in a Republican family. You were comfortable there, and then by the time you're 22 or so, you started getting arrested in demonstrations in Eureka, Boston, Washington, and at the Headwaters Forest for the trees. Can you talk a little bit about yourself and what changed you?
Well, that's part of why I feel good about standing for the peace vigil and being involved in protests and marches and demonstrations. For example, the peace vigil, we don't know what effect we're having, but I always think, you know, I know that if we aren't there, we will have no effect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think back to how I went through the changes in my life. One, I'm so appreciative that my parents didn't teach me to think and act like a racist. We lived in a totally white little town of about 1,000 people in rural Ohio. My mom and dad were both very, very fine people that I loved and had such tremendous respect for. And even though there were never any black people in my community, I never learned to look down on or make distinctions about people who were different from me in some way. So that was a big part of it. And since my dad was a businessman, of course, he was a Republican, and that was back when Republicans were just, you know, the Republican Party represented business people, and the Democrat Party represented unions and people who worked in factories and, you know, kind of the labor class and all of that. So I was, you know, for the first 20 years of my life or so, was just kind of passive Republican, really had no political awareness one way or another. All the way through college, even. I can remember when I was going to Humboldt, and in the late, or the middle 60s, there were people protesting in downtown Eureka at the post office, protesting against the war, against the people of Vietnam, as my friend puts it. And I referred to them, when we saw them on the news, I referred to them as peace creeps. I mean, I was that far removed from where I am now. And you know, finished college, went through a year in the Navy, was fortunate to get out of that and save 3 years of my life after just barely escaping going to Vietnam as a hospital corpsman. And then when I came out, I really began to... I went to teach-ins. I started reading Harper's Magazine, which covered a lot of stuff, anti-war stuff at the time. I read The Militant, The Berkeley Barb, and really sought out alternative sources of information. And also listening to the music at the time. That really had a lot to do with it. I really got heavily involved in the counterculture, politically and otherwise. And the music at the time, Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Jefferson Airplane, a lot of their music had a real strong and clear political content. And from that, I morphed from passive Republican into, you know, I actually studied Marxism for a time. And, you know, I did a complete 180 politically and then became very active in the war, or the anti-war movement and environmental issues. Was a member of the Sierra Club even when I was going to school at Humboldt. So, you know, that was such an awakening. And again, that makes me feel that it's important for us who have strong feelings about social, political activism, that we put ourselves out there where we're visible, that we talk to people, that we say how we feel, that we listen to other people who differ from us. That's important as well. But it's so important, I think, to stand up and say, you know, peace and anti-militarism, you know, social justice for our fellow human beings, and also for the environment that we all depend on, you know, are such important things. And I think we all have to express that in whatever way we can. And it doesn't mean you have to go stand on a street corner, but, you know, talk to your neighbors, talk to your family, speak up in your church or any organization that you're in. Don't be afraid to state how you feel, because one thing, you'll find that you're not alone. There are other people who feel that way too, that may also be hesitant to express themselves because that can be uncomfortable sometimes.
Right. And I just want to backtrack and let people know that the Chico Peace Endeavor Vigil is at the corner of 3rd Street and Main in Chico, and that people stand every Saturday from 12:30 to 1:30 there, and there are some signs available, but during COVID, it's important that people make their own signs so that your sign might address something that's really important to you, like Black Lives Matter, or you might have another issue about your concerns about nuclear war or what's happening in Yemen, I mean, as examples. And so do you want to tag on to that at all, Bob Benfleet?
No, except just to say that, you know, usually we have it varies from 5 to 10 people there on a regular basis with the whole Black Lives Matter awareness campaign that's been going on in the last month or so. We've had a few more people. And almost every time I've been there, new people have joined us. They'll come up and they'll look at our signs and they'll, you know, mostly the responses are very positive. Sometimes they're not, but people will ask us questions. And we've had people who just happen to be walking by and we say, we've got some extra signs, please feel free to join us. So I would just encourage people to feel free to do that if they want to anytime. You know, as you said, Chris, on a Saturday at 12:30, we're there for an hour, rain, shine, heat, whatever, come down and join us. You're more than welcome.
And you know, one of the things about you is that you are a white male, and I was wondering how you feel about this time period when a lot of people are examining what's called white privilege. How do you address that for yourself and for others?
Well, that's something that I've learned from, you know, I've been aware of the term, but I've learned a lot about it from attending the protests that have been going on here in Chico, and especially, and this is really important, those that have had a very strong presence of people of color. I'm especially impressed by the Justice for Desmond group, and I've taken, and I think this is kind of a step one of thinking about white privilege, and that is to, I've tried to apply the principle of listen and learn. Listen to those people who are closest, who are the victims of, or however you want to put it, of an injustice that's been going on for a long time. And I've been fortunate not to have to live with that. So I've learned a lot by listening and learning. So, you know, the concept of white privilege is, it goes beyond racism, and it goes to some really subtle things that I think sometimes those of us who are not, quote, people of color, don't think about. One of the things that I've learned from listening to people's demonstrations is that's so kind of chilling is that African Americans say, people who are white don't have to think every time they go out the door and wonder if they're going to be attacked mm-hmm. by racists, including by the police, or for parents who send their little kids off to school, they have to think about the possibility that their kid may be assaulted or killed on the way to school or shot while they're in school. Boy, talk about a wake-up call. I mean, that's kind of an obvious thing, but it's not really. It's something that I've heard and that I've really had to think about. So that's an example of that kind of examining white privilege. And I really want to gather when the Social Justice Committee of the Unitarian Fellowship can actually get back to meetings. I'd really like to lead a discussion of those of us who have white privilege to really have people talk about what that means to them, what understanding, if any, they have about that term, because it can be pretty subtle, but it can go pretty deep, and I think it's a part of the learning experience that we all need to really go through at this time that's been brought to our attention, sadly and horrifically, by what seems to be just the endless violence perpetrated by people in law enforcement against people of color.
Mm. Yes, yes, and I applaud you for doing that within your church community. That's really important. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of your other work in Chico, because you really hit the ground running, and I think it would be a good way to introduce others through the eyes of a newcomer what's out there. You have been going to the North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition days that are on Sundays. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that impresses you and why you got involved and some of the issues there?
Yeah, well, I've been a volunteer with Chad almost as soon as I came here couple of years ago, and before the virus and all of that, when we were actually still having face-to-face meetings, the subject of the Harm Reduction Coalition came up, and we talked about it, and we were concerned about the fact that it was distribution, not exchange, and that people could get any quantity of needles. There was really no limit on that. And I was kind of leaning toward, I'm not so sure about that myself, until I read up on the concept of harm reduction. And, you know, none of us is saying that addiction is a good thing. We would really like to see everyone get into treatment and into rehab and get rid of their addictions. But the Harm Reduction Coalition is about reducing the harm that comes to people who are addicted and who will be using needles, whether we like it or not, but to reduce the harm that comes to them from reusing or sharing needles because they don't have access to clean ones. Hmm. So about 6 weeks ago, invitation of a friend of mine from DSA, I went down there for the first Sunday, and as I spent 2 hours there seeing people come and go, I really became a believer. I am so totally convinced that this is really a good thing, and the harm reduction refers to preventing infections that come from using dirty needles, especially HIV and hepatitis C infections and other diseases that people can get. And what I learned there, and there are protesters that circle around us as we kind of escort people into the tents to get their supplies, and a couple of those protesters have been almost, well, aggressive is too gentle a word, have been very, very disturbing. For the most part, the protesters are, you know, fairly respectful, and we get along with them. But what really struck me was that, and I would guess in the 6 Sundays I've been there, I've seen 60 to 75 people probably come there for supplies. They get clean needles. They get Narcan if they want that. There are snacks, granola bars, water, sometimes, you know, light groceries, whatever can be available to people, supplies that we can offer them. And even though they don't have to turn in needles to get clean ones, I would say 95% of the people who come bring back used needles in containers that they have. I've seen people bring back as many as 300 needles for clean disposal.
Excellent.
And a big issue of the protesters is, and you know, I totally agree with this, we don't want needles on the playgrounds or in the parks, but every one of the people who comes to the harm reduction clinic brings needles for safe disposal, and those needles do not end up in the park. And so it's just been observing that, and I'm just totally sold on the program. And it's also something some people don't know, it's also sanctioned by the California Department of Public Health as a very important and necessary step in the process of ensuring public health, both for people who use needles, those who are addicted, but also to control the disposed needle problem that can affect other people in the community. So I'm really sold on it.
Yeah, that's great. And I just want to back up again, and you used a couple of letters. You said DSA, and that stands for Democratic Socialists of America, and there's an active group in Chico, and we're really low on time. And you also mentioned CHAT, which stands for Chico Housing Action Team, which you're also very much involved with, and they have, by their own work, housed 158 people in 43 locations in Chico. They have 4 different programs that I'm aware of from their website. And please talk about your experience there in the next 3 minutes that we have.
Okay. Well, to give an indication of the activity at CHAT, I think that the total now is 46. It was probably 43 three or four days ago.
Okay.
We're continually adding places. And the Housing Action Team has been around for probably 7 years or so. It started with some very dedicated community activists who saw the problem of homelessness, and they took the attitude of, you know, we're not sure how we're going to do this, but we're going to do something. And so they just began to make arrangements and connections with property owners, with places where, you know, they could make a deal with the landlords or the owners and help to get people housed. So they've housed people who were driven off the ridge by the fires a couple of years ago. They house the long-term people who are homeless. They have a pretty strict screening procedure, so, you know, it's not just anybody who walks in and gets a house with CHAT. We're pretty careful about doing that, because one of the things that CHAT does is we match people up so that we can make the fullest use possible of what housing properties we have available. So, you know, one place we have is a duplex that houses 4 people in each unit. We have trailers, we have houses, we have apartments, you know, and they're located pretty much all over Chico. And there's a term associated with that, housing first, and that refers to the principle of getting people off the street, out from under bridges, out from unsafe and, you know, sometimes life-threatening circumstances, get them into decent housing first. And then CHAT also, and there's a large number of volunteers, who then make regular contact with people in each of the residences that we have to do a weekly check-in, and as they become more stable, we can engage in conversations about, would you be interested in getting into a drug or alcohol treatment program? Some of my background is a supported employment specialist, so I've worked with some CHAT residents in exploring getting a job. You know, what are resources for doing that?
Mm.
So again, it's housing first, but then we can also, as we develop trusting relationships with people, then hopefully we can kind of lead them to, okay, now what else do you want to address in your life? And that can be, you know, someone getting their kids back. It can be family reunification. It can be getting into drug and alcohol treatment, getting a job, you know, going back to school, all those kinds of things. So, you know, it's more than just housing. It's really offering support and helping people get on with their lives.
Bob Van Fleet, I want to thank you for being on the Peace and Justice program today. I hope our listeners will go by the Chico Peace Endeavor 12:30 any Saturday. You can catch Bob there, get to know him, and learn some of what he is doing so that maybe you too can be involved here in our community. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you so much, Chris, and thanks to KZFR for all the good things they do for this community.
Oh.
It's really amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, so stay tuned for Playing Dead, which will be up with you momentarily. I want to thank our underwriters at this time. I'd like to thank Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010. Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service, and also Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bike valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit ChicoVelo.org and find them on Facebook. And we're going to go into the community calendar. I want to remind you that masks do help to prevent the spread of COVID-19, as well as the other health messaging that we've been hearing so often. And I hope that you will stay safe and be well and have peace.
Hey, KZFR listeners, you know what time it is? It's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar. I am Matt Fidler. In support and celebration of Chico's first African-American church, a group has formed to restore the Bethel AME Church and replace its steeple and bell tower, bringing the church back to its original condition. First built in 1863, this project hopes to show compassion for all and bring dignity, respect, and healing to Chico. To get involved or donate, visit nvcf.org/funds/Bethel. That's from the North Valley Community Foundation. For the most part, we shouldn't be doing a lot right now. The virus is spreading in our area, and certainly we all need to be limiting who we are coming into contact with. But most importantly now, let's just wear our masks. Keep one in your car, keep one in your handbag, your backpack, your purse, whatever. I know it's sometimes it's difficult to remember it, so I'm just trying to keep a mask wherever I go so I don't forget if I'm going to be in any contact with people to be wearing my mask. So we will be able to keep the economy open. We will be able to keep our businesses open. We just need to wear our masks. Remember, there are a lot of